Well, good evening all. Welcome to a fairly unusual night for us to hold a meeting, a Monday night. But there's only 5 days in the week in which we can hold meetings, and we're doing our best to fill the lot. So we're delighted to see you here this evening to talk about something a little bit different. I don't know about you when you were a youngster, but I remember reading about and pirates, because we didn't have television in those days, years and years ago. Reading about pirates.
Hmm? Colour ones.
No, we didn't have colour ones. We didn't have any.
No,
nothing like that. I was poor and deprived, not like others around the place. But reading about pirates and Jolly Rogers and all these sorts of things was a fascinating thing for a young fella being brought up in the bush. And so, as time went on, the concept that there were still pirates around the world really sort of escaped my attention and most everybody else's attention entirely, until the advent of the Indo-Chinese refugee crisis in the 1977-78 period, when a whole heap of people who were journeying down from Southeast Asia in trying to escape from there were in fact invaded and captured and killed by pirates in the South China Sea. Now we have a situation of Somalia, where a number of these issues are being played out at the present time. And I'm very interested, we're very lucky to have with us tonight Mr. Jay Bahadur, who is a Canadian journalist and who is actually going to tell us more about Puntland. So I'm going to get a geography lesson as well, because I had no idea where Puntland was until I read it here, and I thought, Puntland, I better find out about that. And he has actually been there. He is a Canadian freelance journalist who's corresponded for The Times, The New York Times, The Financial Times and CBS News. He now runs the international news website Journalist Nation. And the modern concept of pirates in this part of the world is of much greater significance than I think a whole lot of people really understand and really appreciate. So, Jay, it's with very great pleasure that I invite you to come and tell us all about Deadly Water, the secret of Somalia's pirates.
So it's this microphone, right? Okay. Well, thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here. This is my first time in Australia, so unfortunately, I haven't had a huge amount of time to actually see the sights. But I'm still very happy, of course, to be talking to you here tonight. I went to a region called Puntland in northern Somalia, northeastern Somalia, and this was in 2009, where I spent about 3 months there. And if the reason I wanted you to look at the map is to get an understanding really of why Puntland became the epicenter of modern piracy. And the reason for this is that it intersects the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden. So we're looking at pretty much the tip of the Horn of Africa, which, as I said, cuts into one of the biggest shipping lanes in the world, where about 10% of the world's global shipping goes through. So this is where I ended up. I was at the time 24 years old, not doing much, and sending pitches to editors, which would get no response. And I thought, I want to break into journalism. And these days, with the foreign bureaus pretty much disappearing around the world, you need to go out and really do it on your own. And I kind of did a quick survey of the most dangerous places in the world, and both Afghanistan and Iraq were overloaded with journalists. And so I said, well, Somalia, and piracy was just breaking out at the time. This was in late 2008. It had been going on for a long time, but it really only hit international attention with the hijacking of the MV Faina, which was that, if some of you remember, that tank-carrying transport that was hijacked by pirates, basically 700 kilometers away from Somalia, totally out of nowhere. And this intrigue was increased by the fact that it was actually carrying tanks destined for Sudan, and then ended up selling a lot of its weapons to Somali Islamists once it had actually been captured. So this really made headlines, and I said, well, time to go. And but this didn't end up like a lot of other Somali adventure stories, which was in kidnapping and ransoming. Fortunately, I ended up making contacts there with actually a Melbourne, well, not native, but a Melbourne resident named Mohamed Farole, and his father, Abdirahman Farole, who some of you might know, was actually elected president of Puntland in January 2009. So he has a PhD from La Trobe right here. In, I believe it's building institutions in failed states. So unlike many other people, his academic background has certainly had a direct relevance to his present career. So I spent about 3 months there in Puntland, and I luckily had the access I was given through Mohammed and his father. Obviously, not only was his father the president of the region, but they were also the same subclan as many of the early pirates. And in Somalia, everything is done through clan. It was like I was part of a club, and when I came there, I was protected. Not only did I have armed guards, but I was protected by the fact that any aggression against me, any kidnapping, would have been seen as a direct challenge to the ruling clan. So I just want to set the scene. I did, like I said, I don't have any presentations or visual aids, but I do want to set the scene by playing for you a short video based on footage that I took for CBS. Just to give you an idea of what Puntland is, the problems that it's facing, and what I'm going to show you is footage from Puntland's sole prison. So this is a region of 1.3 million people, about a quarter of Somalia's of its territory, and it has one prison to serve its entire population. And this is expected. This prison has a capacity of 175, and is now, I believe, there's about double that amount being held in the prison, and most of them are pirates. So on YouTube, when I uploaded this to YouTube, I titled it "Pirate Prison," and please enjoy. I think it needs to load for a moment. We'll just let it load for a few moments. So when I was, as I said, I was given access to the pirates through these clan connections. And one of the most sinister of all the figures the pirate figures that I met was a man named Boya, who was known as the godfather of piracy in Puntland, because he was a fisherman, and he had begun actually pirating back in the 1990s. And he and his men had really been aggrieved by foreign fishing coming into Somali territories. I'm sure a lot of you have heard this idea that piracy was a result of foreign fishing. And this was true for a small number of pirates, such as Boya and his men. And they really suffered abuses, like they were shot at. Some of their gear was actually often run over by foreign fishing. Foreign fishing ships actually entered into contracts with local warlords to bring armed guards onto the decks of their ships. And then in the late 1990s began arming themselves with anti-aircraft guns. And at this point, this was 1999, was sort of the point when pirates started looking further afield and began really striking out against commercial vessels. But what's not really that well known is that in 2005, when some of the first really modern Somali pirate attacks happened, they occurred in southern Somalia by a man who was not at all a fisherman. He was actually a man named Hassan Afwene, who was a diaspora member, who was actually a former civil servant, who came back to Somalia and thought, hey, well, I can sort of organize I can organize piracy much as a business. He went around collecting shares, raising venture capital. And when he had assembled his groups, he equipped better crews that had actually longer range ships and could go hundreds of miles into the ocean. And he began by attacking World Food Program transports heading to Mogadishu. And what I think has happened is that a lot of people now just assume that this was an extension of illegal fishing, and this is a justification that pirates continually use when speaking to media. But it's a lot more complicated than that. And the original pirate business model really wasn't at all created out of fishing, and really what you see now is not former fishermen at all, but basically inland gangsters, militiamen who have no histories in fishing and are really conducting it as a business. And it doesn't seem to be slowing down at all, and it doesn't look like it will. So how is Somali piracy organized? I compare it in the book to, it's a free market business characterized by extremely efficient capital flows, low startup costs, few entry barriers, and an extremely high employee turnover. Somali pirates generally operate in groups of 50 to 150. And it really congregates around the money. It's assumed that it's thought that there's about 15 to 30 key investors within Somalia. And these key investors essentially contract a mission out to a pirate group. We'll have a leader who organizes the mission, will provide the boats, the weapons, the fuel, the food, and the drugs for his men, because along with food, a pirate needs to get by with this drug called khat, which is it's a leafy narcotic that they chew on, really, to keep them high all day, sort of similar to coca leaf or betel nut. And this man, the financier, will take 50% off the top. And I want to tell you a quick story about a group that I was investigating when I was in Somalia. It was run by a man named Computer. And the reason this man had gained his name, he had a reputation as a psychic. And as a psychic, this sort of... basically was not taken very well by a group of local Muslim holy men, because they went up to him and they said to him, "Listen to me, Computer. People say you're psychic. And, you know, this is not acceptable. Because only God can see the future, not people like you." And so Computer said to them, "No, I'm a psychic. No, it's absolutely true. Whatever you've heard is true." And so what they did is they took some money, bundled it, buried it in the desert, and said to him, "Well, Computer, if you're a psychic, then go and find our money." And the legend is, apparently, he made a beeline directly into the desert, dug up the money, found the money, and at this point his legend was secured. And people said to him, or the clerics came back to him and said, "My God, you know everything. You're a computer." So this man actually gained his reputation, became a pirate leader, basically because pirates used to come to him for advice. And after a while, he started thinking, "Well, you know, I don't need to keep on giving advice. I can just organize my own mission." And so he selected a very close group of his cousins and basically gave them directions on how to find a ship. And he said, "Go into the ocean. Go straight for 8 hours, you're going to see a ship. Pass it on the right, continue for another 2 hours, you're going to see another ship. That's the ship you're going to capture." And it turned out exactly as he said. And the ship actually was being held when I was in Somalia. and Computer, that they finally garnered in $1.8 million ransom for that ship. Computer got $900,000 of that right off the top. And one of the myths about Somali piracy is that pirates are turning into local, basically kingpins, local cash-flush gangsters. And this is really not the case. It's only the top financiers, again, these 15 to 40 men, who provide all the cash for the missions, that actually end up with any sort of sustained rise in living. And the lower downs, in this group that I was researching, the lower downs actually made $10,000 to $12,000. And so that worked out to about $10 an hour, for which they, in order to earn, they spend about 75 days on board a ship guarding hostages. Hopefully, I'm just going to show, hopefully I can show this now. It looks like it's ready. And I just wanted to use this to segue into some of the problems Puntland is facing and very quickly go over what I think some solutions to piracy are. My translator here, he's actually from Melbourne as well. Well, that was just a little, a brief window into Puntland. But you notice there that those men who knelt and told me they were fishermen, that was essentially the challenge of covering Somali piracy. Going, and you had a very real sense. I was speaking earlier about how fishing was never actually, it's a psychological justification pirates use now. And there's such an active pirate PR machine. I think it's real. I'm not sure, but I think there's a pirate central command somewhere which issues press releases to pirates. And those men were just sort of a small taste of the kind of wall you had to break down when you were speaking to pirates. Puntland, just briefly, I want to wrap up now. But what a very central argument I make in the book is that the whole international strategy surrounding Somali piracy or surrounding Somalia led in part to the outbreak of Somali piracy. Many people have not even heard of Puntland and think of Somalia as a land completely in chaos. Warlords, jihadis, Black Hawk Down, that kind of thing. But there's actually a number of small states like Puntland which have cobbled themselves together out of nothing from the ground up. The international community continues to ignore the reality in favor of a federal Somalia and has since 2000 has supported a top-down imposed government in Mogadishu. What this has meant, essentially, is that there's been no bilateral or multilateral aid to Puntland, Somaliland, which is another one of these regions. And the reason piracy exploded in 2008, it's not just because Somalia was an anarchy, that Somalia was poor, that Somalia had a perfect geographical location to take advantage of from which to launch pirate attacks. These were all underlying factors that had not changed since the state collapsed in 1991. So why did it take until 2008 for piracy to explode? And the reason for that was that in 2008, the Puntland government essentially ran out of money to pay its security forces. So what you had was a lot of men unemployed, without guns, sitting around with not much to do. And after the monsoon season, the summer monsoons ended in 2008, piracy exploded, completely became the international menace it is now. So briefly in terms of solutions, I think essentially what you need to do is start refocusing on these mini-states where things actually work in Somalia. In the book I talk about basically setting up coastal garrisons along Puntland, directly providing aid to the Puntland security forces, even encouraging things like a pirate hotline. A kind of a number you call when you have a tip about, my cousin or so and so. I see him. He's about to launch into the Indian Ocean. He's a pirate. He's been talking about it for weeks. Come get him, and offer small rewards of $50 to $150. That kind of thing. The pirates are universally hated on ground, and this is really an intelligent resource. These local regions and the governments that inhabit them and the people within them are an intelligence resource that has totally not been accessed, and the international community is very much focused on supporting the federal government and, of course, in terms of combating piracy, totally ineffectual international naval missions, which cost, $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year. And have achieved very little in the way of combating piracy. Anyway, I've tried to provide a very, very general overview there, and I'm really interested in your questions now because I'm sure you know what you want to know. So, please, I'll open it up.
You take questions now, will you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you heard Jay. He said he wants to answer questions, and I'm sure there's a few around the place. Who would like to start? I think you had one,
Graham Barrett with the Institute. Why are the naval forces so ineffectual? Is that deliberate, or is it just they simply cannot cope?
Well, I wouldn't say it's deliberate, but in 2008, when the European Union fleet first arrived, NATO and the European Union arrived in late 2008, they were very effective in clamping down in the Gulf of Aden, where most of the attacks were occurring. This is when the pirates were only going out 100 kilometers, 200, maybe 300 kilometers into the Gulf of Aden. What happened then is that they set up a transit corridor. All shipping was routed very close to the Yemeni side of the border. And they set up escorts and convoy schedules. They set up a marine security center that every ship coming through that area was supposed to call into. The problem is that the pirates very quickly adapted. And I spoke briefly before about these motherships they use. And what essentially they started doing is attacking Yemeni dhows in many cases. God knows what happened to the crews. And then using those dhows as ships enabling them to go into the Indian Ocean. And when you get out there, essentially you have an area about 80% of the size of the United States where you know being patrolled by 20 to 40 warships. It's just not feasible. Even assuming a warship has the capability, has a naval attack helicopter ready to go, which is not all of them by any means, you need to be within 70, 80 kilometers from the site of an attack in order to mount any sort of rescue operation. And like I said, they're operating in an area 8-9 million square kilometers large.
So the Red Sea is safe enough, but the Indian Ocean is not?
The Red Sea actually isn't safe anymore. There have actually been a few incidences of copycat Eritrean pirates, actually. And now the Somali pirates are starting to attack in the Red Sea. They're very good at adapting. And one way they've adapted, again, is pushing out further and also into the Red Sea. In the Red Sea, actually, there's been a few attacks lately which are very atypical in the sense that about 8 or 9 pirate ships swarmed a vessel, whereas normally it's just 2.
Who else?
Yes. So why can't, say, an air force, I'm not saying which country's air force, just start bombing them?
Well, that was actually a suggestion put forth by an extremely the extremely bloodthirsty ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, I think, who actually advocated for a complete invasion of Somalia. I don't think he had read his 2-decade past history book. But I know what you're saying. No, they were. But the fact is, these so-called pirate bases, right? They're just communities of fishermen, and you wouldn't be achieving anything because there's no pirate infrastructure to bomb. You would just be killing innocent people, and turning a local population, which is again is very much anti-pirate, into a population that would be very pro-pirate. But the thing is, what happens is when the pirates are threatened in any area, all they do is pick up and move a little north or a little south. They don't actually need any infrastructure that you can target with bombs or anything. It's just simply they need a small village to supply their needs, food, drugs, water, and they need a semi protected port. That's it, natural harbor.
Yep.
The Philip and the allies, the people who are trying to deal with this problem, as I understand, when they capture any of these pirates, they're not dealt with by the allies themselves, but they're landed and dealt with by the civil infrastructure in whichever country they land them in. And as far as I can ascertain, very few ever seem to get to the end of the legal process and either stay in jail forever or executed. Whereas I understand that the Russians actually have taken far more vigorous steps to make sure pirates don't attract their ships. What's the success rate in dealing with these pirates they actually capture? What do they do with them?
I think there's something like 1,000 being held in custody around the world, including about, now in that one prison I was telling you, probably about 200 there. Probably 100 or so around the rest of Somalia. But in short, what they're doing is they're just, as you say, they're using local states as dumping ground for pirates, mostly Kenya and Yemen. A number of them have been processed, but the thing is, it's such, no one knows what to do with them legally.
But under international law, piracy is a capital offence. You can shoot them and hang them, can't you?
Well, maybe, maybe that would have been acceptable in the 17th century, but now, I think now, well, you can't, first of all, summary executions are sort of frowned upon these days. The Russians have done it, not publicly admitted. But what happened was there was a vessel called the Marshal Sharpsikov, I think, that was captured by Russian forces. They, for some reason, engaged the commandos in a gun battle. One pirate was killed. The rest were rounded up, and then the Russians claimed to have released them, and that they, an hour later, announced that they had, quote, perished at sea. And so a far more likely scenario is that they, summarily executed them on the deck of a ship. That being said, I don't think any country wants to really take after Russia these days. And if obviously if that became a standard practice, there'd be a lot of human rights outcry and so on. I mean, and another problem is that you mentioned, you know, you asked about the problem with international naval interdiction. Another problem is that you can't really tell the difference between pirates and fishermen. I mean, fishermen, Somali fishermen, will have guns as well. They might even have RPG launchers. God knows they need them out there. And if you start just summarily executing people on, you know, very poor probable cause, you know, it's going to raise a lot of issues internationally.
If there are only 15 to 40 who actually make a lot of money and they're disliked in the community, why do the rest of them get involved?
I've asked myself that many times because it doesn't lead to a sustained rise in living. There was a recent very good story by a local Somali news agency that went out to Hobyo, which is one of these pirate bases, and they noticed a fleet of land cruisers abandoned along the shore. And they were all owned by pirates, and they interviewed one pirate who owned six of them, and he'd abandoned each one because it had a scratch on it, or its mirror had broken off, or one because it was out of gas. And I mean, these may be sort of caricatures and exaggerations, but it's very much just about immediately getting some status, buying a car, buying the newest car. It's really like, I compare it somewhat, although I don't want to draw too many comparisons to inner city gang culture in the United States. But this idea that you need to get out and immediately show people who you are, that you're a man, that you're important, that very much is a mentality shared by Somali pirates. But like I said, the money goes to cars is one thing, and then kat, this drug I spoke of, and which means the money immediately goes back into international markets. The drug comes from Kenya and Ethiopia. Land cruisers are generally imported from Dubai. And so really it only lasts 2 weeks, a month, 2 months. And then, of course, all their friends and family expect their handouts as well. So for the lower down guys, it's very much, it's just, you know, easy come, easy go, really.
Yep.
In your video, these people were claiming they were flying fishermen and in prison. Is that likely to be the fact? Or
no, they're lying. Yeah, it's just like I said, it's very much the pirates monitor international news. They know exactly what people write about them. And one thing that I find very annoying about the media coverage of Somali piracy is that they just cast it. It's a very easy motif to understand, right? Western exploitation, even though for the most case the illegal fishing ships came from South Asia. But this idea of Western exploitation, of stealing resources, and that this piracy was a natural reaction, you know, a natural backlash. And that is a very easy motif, and they know that it is. And they know that the international media picks up on that. And, like I said, the pirates are very conscious of how they portray themselves.
And arms and things, how do you tell what's a fishing boat and what's...
Well, I was speaking about when this early piracy started in the 90s, targeted at fishing boats, they very quickly started arming themselves much more heavily. That said, now there's illegal fishing really has been reduced around Somalia because it's, you know, even more dangerous now. But there's still French and largely French and Spanish tuna trawlers that are a lot further out, couple hundred kilometers out, that are still very much engaged in illegal fishing in Somalia. But rarely now do ships come that close anymore.
How many mini states are there, Jeff?
Well, I can think of 1, 2, 3, 5 off the top of my head. There's Puntland, Galmudug, which is another much weaker state to the south of Puntland where piracy is really located now. Actually, it's interesting. What happened, I mentioned the Gulf of Aden was clamped down on, right, in 2008. When they all started going out east, Puntland kind of lost some of its geostrategic importance and it shifted south to this Galmudug area. Again, I wish I had a map, but another one is Somaliland, which is actually a region that's declared outright independence from Somalia. And then there's Jubaland, which is now sort of in the kind of warlord state just north of the Kenyan border. Himin and Heb is another one, which is, I'm not really sure if it exists so much, but more, beyond paper, but And then there's actually a number of states which have kind of cropped up briefly and then died. And so they're within Puntland itself, because Puntland is, it's one clan family, but within that family there's a lot of squabbling, and occasionally their clan branches just come out and declare independent, you know, declare their own regions. So.
Question.
Oh, yeah, beg your pardon, I didn't
know. That's right, my peripheral vision is not that.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks, Bert. You mentioned the 40 influential people. I'm Steve Moon from the Institute. I'm just surprised that no one has sort of asked the question, well, if these 40 were made ineffectual somehow, what difference would that make? Wouldn't it have a bit of a major impact on your, the tone of your talk? You're sort of implying that they are pretty well running show at this stage.
Yeah, they're the ones, these sort of investors are people who have money that they've probably made outside the country, like Somali, there's a lot of Somali businessmen who split their time between, you know, the Gulf states and Somalia or Kenya, and basically like Computer, who I believe was a former police lieutenant, but some escaped the country. They just come in and say, and like Ifwene, the one I mentioned earlier, who really invented piracy, they come in and say, okay, well, I'm, you know, spending my 3 months of the year that I normally do in Somalia. Oh, here's, you know, my cousins are involved in piracy. They want some money. Why don't I give them some? That being said, there isn't that much money that actually goes into funding a pirate mission. I mean, you could do it for $20,000, easy. A more sophisticated mission might cost $50,000. But the point is, you can eliminate these people, but there's plenty of other people with that kind of money in. And I say 15 to 40, that's a very large span, because no one really knows. They're kind of cropping up and disappearing constantly. They're names that keep coming up that, you know, international police institutions and are aware of, like Interpol is aware of, for example. But really, it's hard to say exactly how many there are, and it's not like they're critical individuals. So piracy just works as kind of a loose constellation centered around a financier. In fact, there, I can tell you about this after if you want, but there's a think tank in the United States that's now begun to track pirate networks, much like Facebook networks, just social networks based around connections between individuals. They're not any concrete mafia-like institutions. It's just the friends and family floating around certain key individuals. But that's also complicated by the fact that these guys go by often four or five different names as well. So,
yep. No. Bill.
What is the solution? What may be the solution? And is there any movement in the world by the powers, you know, the powerful nations of the world, to get rid of this, solve it?
To get rid of piracy? Well, like I said, there's the naval missions, which there are three of them, the EU, NATO, and a fleet based around the US Fifth Fleet called Combined Task Force 151. So they're making, I think, they're going through the motions. They have to show that they're doing something, and what they're doing is deploying warships. Like I sort of tried to say when I was speaking earlier, was that I think you need to basically shore up police capabilities in these regional states like Puntland and Galmudug. And there was actually a project very recently that was funded, the United Arab Emirates actually funded a coastal task force for Puntland that involved a militia of 1,000 strong, I think six sort of armored transports, even marine aircraft. And this, that's the sort of thing I was talking about. That was unfortunately kiboshed by the United Nations because, A, they said it was a violation of the arms embargo on Somalia, and two, it was run by an extremely shady private security company run by, as many of these things are, by ex-South African who had been involved in an internal security state apparatus during apartheid. And so for those reasons, there was a lot of media pressure and UN pressure. It was kiboshed. But I think what would be critical in any sort of project like that would be that you need to have it coming from an Arab country, another Muslim country. You can't have a U.S. funded project like that, and you certainly can't have U.S. people, American or really any Europeans and so on. Well, you'd provoke an Islamist backlash. Like in the South, you saw what happened. Like when Ethiopia invaded, who's seen as sort of these Christian imperialists in Somalia, invaded in 2006, backed by U.S. air support and logistics support, it essentially provoked this Islamist extremist backlash that became known as Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab was basically just a clan militia or various clan militias that once these imperialists, these outsiders came in, really radicalized and launched this just obviously brutal insurgency that has really made Somalia a lot worse than it was 5 years ago.
Well, what is the solution? What is required to solve this thing?
To solve it? I'm just saying there's a plan, if you want to get into specifics, for 8 coastal garrisons in Puntland, and that was sort of what this UAE funded project was trying to achieve. I think eventually you need to build basic road infrastructure, because right now you have the troops in the central cities, there's no roads out there, and they have to deploy with all-terrain vehicles that take them 8 hours to get to the coast at great cost. So I said earlier, this is kind of, you need to fund intelligent networks through phone lines, things like pirate tip hotlines. If you have troops that can't respond in fewer than 8 hours, that sort of thing isn't going to work.
Warships and just destroy these people.
I think that's what this lady asked before, but you'd basically be just killing civilians. It wouldn't be, it wouldn't be an effective thing to do.
Right.
Yeah.
The first stage of taking a ship is relatively brutal, but the next stage of converting that into money is quite sophisticated. Who does that negotiation to turn a ship that's been taken into cash?
Well, the pirates they'll always have a negotiator on board who will often just as well be the translator for the crew. And these people are kind of like hired guns. They're contract workers. And in fact, I told you a bit about Computer's mission where his gang captured a ship. They hired a translator who was not part of the gang. He came on board their ship 3 days after he'd finished his last mission. So these guys are often also hold foreign passports. They have to speak English, obviously. They hold foreign passports, and they're paid pretty well by the pirates.
But they're the critical link, aren't they?
Well, they don't really. I mean, they could be replaced. It's not like it's just someone who speaks English. And I would argue that they're not very sophisticated at all. I think the reason you see ransom payments skyrocketing now, back from in 2000 when I was there, 2009, maybe $1.5 million to $2.5 million, somewhere in that range is the average ransom. Now the average ransom is up around $5-6 million, and there's one paid $13.5 million earlier this year. And I think the reason for that is that pirate negotiators really did not understand how little they were asking for at the beginning. Like, they were asking for, 1 or 2% of the value of the ship. And they were not nearly as well organized or as experienced as, like, say, FARC or even Taliban, those kind of kidnappers. And only now have they started to even use tactics like beatings and torture and things like that to put pressure on shipping companies. Even something as simple as sending videos of the crew in distress is something they've only recently discovered. And, they're not sending fingers and toes yet or things like that. But, I think that's the natural evolution of how it's going.
But Jay, how much in total has been collected and how much is this thing costing?
$302 million. No, I don't know exactly how much because shipping companies generally don't publicize their ransom figures, or very often don't, because they don't want to fuel precedence in negotiations. But I think it's about, since it began in 2007, really, well, 2008 in force, it's probably about $300 million, something like that.
There's a question down the back here, I think.
I was just wondering... how does Somali culture or religion affect piracy? Like, say they're not really liked back home, is that?
Yeah, and no, absolutely, and they're actually looked upon quite negatively on land by other Somalis because they're perceived as very un-Islamic. They chew this khat, which is kind of, you know, seen as not very religious. They consume alcohol, and they also often will skirt traditional ways of, say, courting and marrying women, and just essentially do these Islamic pleasure marriages, which are basically just ways to circumnavigate the rules of, or circumvent, sorry, the rules of Islam against casual sex. So you basically just verbally pronounce that you're married. A week later, you can pronounce it by, again, verbally, your divorce. And I think there's an ongoing debate whether you can actually do it by text message. So you get the sense that this is just a way to have sex. And, but the pirates, I mean, it's very common for pirates, once they get their ransoms, to immediately run, leave their wives and children, find a new wife for a couple of weeks, go to a hotel, and then, yeah, and this is obviously not viewed very well by local people. They also drive up the prices in the coastal areas. Their supplying of their ships they capture drives up local prices for food and goats and things. So that's another reason they're hated. But they're seriously universally hated.
Jay, we have been.
Oh, wonderful. That's actually very useful.
Would you like to talk to it a little bit?
Well, I mean, this is the only thing I'd point out is that Gamudug is here, basically, which is the other sort of semi-autonomous region that has spawned piracy.
Is there any connection between what you're talking about, the whole thing this evening, and the awful starvation and warfare that's occurring just inland? You know, you see these terrible pictures in the newspapers,
yeah,
with children with arms that look like bones.
Yeah, no, in short, no. I mean, piracy again is confined to a region pretty much.
And at sea.
Well, yeah, and the famine is pretty much focused in the south, yeah, and has largely been created by Al Shabaab.
My question is, you said the fund of pirate trip is sort of 20,000 to 50,000, but presumably these folks must be high speed. First of all, they carry just a dozen people, so they can't be too small. They're out in the open ocean, they must have sleeping accommodation, high speed engines. I just can't see how you could fund a ship like that with such a small amount.
Well, they essentially use fishing skiffs, I mean, to attack, and those they probably already have, are about maybe 4 or 5 meters long at most, and use, 75 horsepower outboard motor would be a very typical, typical engine, and that, I don't know, buying one of those even new must more than $3,000-$4,000.
You wouldn't go out in the ocean.
No, you would go using, well, I mean, this is where the Yemeni fishing dhow, I wish I had some photos of exactly what these pirates look like when they're captured in boats. They don't have sleeping accommodations, let me tell you. They're sleeping literally on top of each other on the deck. So these, like, Yemeni fishing boats might be 10, 15 meters long. And they carry, the fuel is what's expensive, but the simple fact is they pretty much head out as far as they can and cut their engines and just wait and get, you know, they drift along with the currents. And very, very often they don't have enough fuel to get back when they're going, you know, 800 miles into the ocean. They don't have enough fuel to get back. And it's all about, either I capture a ship or I die. This is what one pirate insider actually involved in Computer's gang told me. All his cousins were the ones who were actually in the boat attacking. And he said to me, you know, all they want is a land cruiser. And they say to themselves, if I don't get a land cruiser, it's better to be dead. And often, you know, it's not at all uncommon for pirates just to be found in boats, dehydrated and dead. And it's,
How does a little boat get a big boat? I mean, there must be big ships coming through. How are these little things? Why don't the big ships just shoot them down?
Well, that's another question. But essentially, they tend to target ships with very low freeboards, which mean the area from the watermark, the waterline to the deck. So a freeboard of about, 4 meters or less is kind of the ships they target. And, you know, they have ladders that are 4 meters and some, you know, ropes with grappling hooks and things. So it's kind of like a high-speed chase on the ocean. And the reason ships don't shoot back, I can get into that, and it's a more detailed question. But basically, arming the merchant marine is something that was discussed and ultimately dismissed as too dangerous. And just from the fact that you risk A, escalating incidents, and B, you have to pay them more. Like, if you, not only do you have to train your crew how to use weapons, and a lot of the time when they can't even communicate with each other, crews are often made up of 3 or 4 different nationalities speaking different languages. So you're basically looking at training your crews as crack mercenaries when they often can't even speak to each other, and when you probably have to pay them double or more to do it. So the shipping industry is extremely it's cutthroat, really. There's not a lot of money in budgets for these kind of things, and that particular arming crew was something that was rejected, you know, quite early on.
You mentioned the connection you had with the clan leader to get in. I'm just wondering on what grounds you got in and out to be able to stay there.
As I mentioned, this was an election time in Puntland, and the government had largely collapsed from 2007 to 2009. And when Farole got in, it was also his sub-clan coming into power, and they kind of really wanted to reboot Puntland's image and make it a valid actor on the international stage. And so I was sort of being used to write Puntland government propaganda. I think that's what they thought, anyway. And actually, my partners were not really happy with the end product of the book, even though I thought it was like very, very pro-Puntland, in that I was saying, you know, recognize these regions, go in and deal with them, because they're what the reality on the ground. But I don't think they liked the fact that I talked about the president's alleged dealing, you know, accepting money from pirates, which he probably did, and things like that. So, yeah, they wanted me, I think, to be an organ of the Puntland government, and that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just why do they form the ships into small convoys with one, so one destroyer, one helicopter, 10?
They do.
And they could get across. Obviously, no pirates. If they do attack, then they should kill them.
Well, convoys generally take place at the mouth of the Gulf of Aden, because it's very difficult for ships to just randomly meet up. I mean, that's a natural point for ships coming from everywhere to meet up, right? Like when you get to say there. Problems are. With that are that you really need to have ships moving along at the same schedule. You need to have a minimum speed. So if your ship is doing 5 knots, you just can't be part of a convoy, because they won't allow you. There are a lot of like oil super tankers, really. The pirates target often move at 5 knots, 6 knots. Yeah, and essentially, if you have a scheduled berth in the Suez Canal, right? So if you're off by just a few hours, you miss it. That's, I think, $200,000 for a container ship to go through there. So the timing, again, is very critical. And again, you're constrained to the speed of your slowest ship, which is a problem for a lot of vessels. So they do use convoys, though. The problem is that protection doesn't kick in until you get to the Gulf of Aden, really.
Mike, just one other point. As of 2 years ago, in international law of the sea, if a ship is attacked by pirates and the captain gets the better of the pirates, he can summarily execute them.
Really?
That's still on the books, yeah.
I did not know that.
You can shoot them.
I did not know that, but that's interesting.
My peripheral vision is improved.
Thank you, Mike. Jay, recently the Institute with members were able to go along here to President of the Seychelles, give a presentation, and he said that they've made so much money, these pirates, now that they've actually got motherships. And you haven't mentioned that, but he was suggesting that, yes, it really is big business now. Your argument has been, if I've correctly understood it, that if you cut off the 40 people, you know, the big players now, it wouldn't make any difference. More people would step in. But he was suggesting, the way I've understood it, a slightly different story to the story that you've been telling. Well, at least your story is consistent with his, but he was saying motherships, you know, big business, big players, slightly different emphasis.
But these motherships are just these like fishing dhows I was talking about. That's all that's meant by a mothership. Like maybe you're imagining a huge. It's actually interesting though. Piracy generally shuts down during the monsoons, right, from about May to September. And there was talk earlier this year that it might not, because not only like what they've started doing is they've started using ships they've captured, so like 30,000 ton dead, you know, deadweight ton tankers, not tankers, but container ships and so on, that have been captured. They started using these as motherships, and obviously those are not affected by the winds of the monsoon, which is what normally grounds the pirates. So there was some, you know, people that were thinking that piracy is not going to shut down this summer. It has, but it is interesting that the pirates now are using their own ships they've captured to capture more ships, and they're calling them large pirate support vessels.
That's what he was saying.
Right. But right, and those have been spotted conducting pirate operations, but as far as I know, there haven't actually been more than a couple incidences where attacks have actually been launched from those ships.
Why don't they take out these big players?
Easy take out.
Sorry? Well, because they carry the crews along, that's why. What, you mean the large pirate support vessels, are you saying? Or?
And get rid of the big players, why not?
Well, because I think it's hard. It's hard to go into Somalia and assassinate people.
I'm not saying assassinate them, but use every method, you know, to neutralize.
What would you? What method do you suggest?
You might be right.
Sending them a poison cake.
I don't know.
Ladies I just and gentlemen, just a second. Let's see if we can get it back into some sort of order. Down the back there.
My question is to do with, you've mentioned this is very much a business. I'm thinking all the time about the transfer of the ransom money, how this takes place, whether it's wired currency or, you know, is there any way of trying to cut piracy in that way, or is it just physical transfer of cash?
Oh, cutting ransom payments.
Yeah,
yeah, well, they actually... I mean, they wouldn't want to. That's sort of the shipping company's business. There's no pirates aren't considered terrorists, so there's not really any laws against paying ransoms in most countries. So, I mean, sorry. Well, I think it's too late for that now. Was your question why not just stop people from being ransoms? Is that
how do they transfer money?
Okay, well, it's generally loaded, routed through either banks in largely Dubai or Nairobi, and yeah, it's physical cash that's loaded into planes and taken by private security teams and dropped. So you have a team there just to make sure everything's okay. If something goes wrong with the release, there's really not that much they can do. But because of the use of private security to deliver ransoms, they often end up being, and legal fees as well, they end up being often twice as much as what the pirates are getting.
Yeah.
So earlier you mentioned the Islamist movement, Al-Shabaab. Is there any relationship between that organization, that insurgency, the piracy, or is that largely restricted to the north?
That's a very good and deep question, and I'll try and answer as quickly as possible. And I'm glad I have the map now, because very early on, there was a lot of misinformation that there was a connection. And one really, really kind of crappy report from a think tank suggested that there were actually pirate training camps in Shabab-controlled territories, where Shabab was teaching the pirates how to shoot in exchange for like sailing lessons. And it was a crazy thought, because every Somali basically over the age of 13 knows how to use an AK-47. And the idea that you needed to be a sharpshooter to be a pirate was so absurd. And as was the idea that Shabab was somehow launching a maritime division, which never happened. So this was one report that came out that was largely, you know, proved to be complete bunkum. And then when I mentioned the Faina, where the weapons were actually sold to Shabab, not the tanks, but the small arms that were on the ship. And so immediately, the reason you had four U.S. warships essentially surrounded that vessel the moment it was actually taken to port around there. And the reason for that was that they were worried about Shabab getting a hold of the weapons. Not the tanks, because there's no way to offload those, nor would you need Somalia is a terrible country to use a tank. But in any case, those weapons did end up getting a lot of the time into Shabab's hands. And so that was another reason that people started clamoring, you know, that there were connections. I found actually no hard evidence until basically last year that there was any money getting transferred. And the reason for that is that these pirates aren't ideologues. They're not Islamists. They think that Shabab is as nuts as you and I think. But it's all about the money for them. And if the Shabab is not physically controlling the territory out of which they operate, then they have no reason to give them any money. That being said, last year Shabab kind of pushed north and took Herradura. It's not on the map, but it's one of the main pirate bases. And these pirates who were stuck with ships there were like, well, oops, we're going to have to get our ransoms. We're going to have to get out of here somehow. And there are these guys with guns, you know, who want a piece of our action. And so there's firm evidence that about $1 million was paid by various pirate groups to Shabab, between, you know, 5% and 10% of each ransom. But now most of them just go north. Now those guys who are there are not going to operate out of Herradura anymore. They go north and out of Shabab-controlled territory. And once they're there, it's really no reason they'd ever send money to Shabab.
We've got time for two more, one here and one there. You, young man.
I'm just interested in how, like, shipping companies, because I've read a lot about how shipping companies, like, there's quite a lot of, like, bad practices going on, especially in the west half of Africa, coming out of Guinea places. Could the shipping companies do more to stop piracy, or is it really not in their interest just to pay the ransoms when they need to?
Yeah, excuse me. It's essentially a cost of doing business. I mean, still now, they have insurance, right? So once they've paid for the insurance, it's all moot. They'd rather not be hijacked, but they're not going to risk a confrontation with the pirates once they're insured, right? And generally, it's, yeah, insurance is getting pretty bad. But some shipping companies have rerouted around southern Africa, but that's only about, I think, about 10% of shipping, and ships that really are prime targets, like these super tankers, like going at 5-6 knots that I spoke about. But shipping companies now, they'll take basic security measures, you know, hook up high pressure hoses, barbed wire, that kind of thing, buy insurance. But really, so few ships still get hijacked going through there. It's something like, you know, fewer than 0.2-0.3%, and it's just, and even if you get hijacked, then you're going to pay probably now 6-7% of the worth of the vessel and the cargo. It's not the end of the world, you know.
Right.
Yeah. I just want, first of all, make a remark that I was a bit incredulous that not so much the average fisherman, but some of these fishermen have RPGs on board. First of all, it's not a usual part of fishing equipment. Secondly, it costs a couple of thousand to buy an RPG on the second-hand market, and I'm just a bit surprised that anyone who's caught with an RPG can claim to be a fisherman. That notwithstanding, what successful coping strategies have been used by not so much the commercial fleets and the Navy and all that infrastructure, but commercial, you know, pleasure craft and things that have to move down this coast? I mean, you're saying if they go out 200-300 miles, they're still vulnerable. But we don't hear of success stories of people who've been potentially overrun who've dealt with the situation. I mean, what coping structures are there, short of having the US Navy beside?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the most effective, probably the most effective measure, is just to have extra watches on deck. Essentially, okay, it takes about, generally crews have about 20 to 40 minutes between sighting a pirate group and getting boarded. If you're on the 20-minute side, you're finished. If you're on the 40-minute side, there's a very good chance that they'll see you taking evasive maneuvers and just leave you alone. It's like it's an opportunistic crime, right?
And in the mouth, huh? Not very sophisticated.
Well, it doesn't have to be sophisticated. Right now, what you have is, since the 70s, shipping international commercial vessels have been running on fewer and fewer crew members, where, you know, you might have had in the 70s a crew of 25 or so for a given ship, say a large container ship. Now it's running on 11 to 15. And you simply have huge degree of fatigue among the crew members, only one officer of the watch at any time. And simply spotting them coming, seriously, is, you know, that's what maritime experts say. It's not me that's saying that. It's that simply spotting them with a greater window of time to react is the number one way you can deter pirate attacks. There's also many other, I mean, there's many best management practices, they're called, that the IMO, International Maritime Organization, has encouraged ship owners to implement. Barbed wire is one of them. You know, like I said, positioning these high-powered hoses, those are largely useless, to be honest. Turning off your transponder, when going through.
Daylight or night?
They attack at dusk, usually dusk or dawn. Where they, again, it comes to the point of not wanting to be seen, right? That's the number one criterion, and but they still need to see. So dusk and dawn tend to be when they attack.
Jay, I've got two very important questioners down the
back. Can I make a quick observation? I was head of the Australian National Line, chief executive, and there were pirates north of Australia too, apart from around the Somali area, and for a while our captains used to carry firearms to repel them, but fortunately it wasn't as well organised as the Somali pirates. Mm. Quick observation.
Oh, thanks very much. Now, down the back, quickly.
All of these men, surely that we could give them some more money for their fish, and the protein could go to the south, and the people who are pressing into Kenya, starving 12 million of them, Somali, would. No, it's incredible that they're trying to make money out of stealing other ships when the product that they are harnessing, the fish out of the sea, could be so used. Look, it's not all that big country for the people. Instead of pressing into Kenya, they should be going, you know, towards the sea and asking for fish for food. We're all worried about
I don't think the pirates have the same compunctions about it you do, to be honest. And as I mentioned earlier, the modern piracy movement began with the pirates attacking ships carrying food aid to their own countrymen. This is why, and to this day, the European Union reserves one ship to escort WFP shipments into Mogadishu. Because of pirates.
This is definitely the last question. Yes.
I was just wondering if you could comment just quickly on women and piracy. There's been nothing said about how it affects them, or are they involved in it?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I tried desperately to get a female perspective when I was there. And this is a problem, when, especially if you're a male reporter in Muslim countries. It's very difficult to get to the women. And in Somalia, it's actually not quite as conservative as other places. But I did hear rumors of a woman pirate who had invested in a captured Malaysian ship. And it was just, she was like a specter to me, because I was hearing rumors of her from everyone I met. Some people were even saying she didn't exist. Some say they did, she did exist. Some said she was in the bush somewhere. And in the end, the report I had was she was in the bush somewhere. And out of cell phone reception, I couldn't get to her, unfortunately. What I did end up doing was, for a female perspective in the book, as much as I could get, was write a chapter on Kat, where in which all the people who sell the cot are women. In fact, there are more women working in Somalia than men, probably, and a large number of them are employed in the cot market, which is exclusively women. And so I did interview a few cot dealers and got their perspective on why women have to work and what they think of the men chewing cot and how piracy has affected them and so on. But again, it was tough. It was tough.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this has probably been the most discursive discussion that I've heard for a very long time at the Institute. And Jay, thank you very much indeed. Would you join with me in thanking Jay for having me?